Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Previously,
Louis Deathstalker, you have betrayed your king with the woman who is to be his queen. You are not fit to be Imperial Champion. You are hereby stripped of that office on the authority of the king and this house.
What are you doing here, Saturday? What's the deal with this ship?
I want to see some real action.
Hi there, I'm Brett Random. Seems we're fated to work together too. I think you probably know my companion.
Everyone knows the Wild Rose of the arena. Do I take it you both want to join up as well?
Finn was responsible for everything that happened in that riot. He planned it, orchestrated it from beginning to end. He planted agent provocateurs in the Neumann March and in the crowds to stir things up and push them out of control. One of them shot the Paragon Veronica May Savage on his orders and started a whole blood and slaughter that came after. It was all designed to intimidate Parliament and discredit the Paragons. There's nothing he won't do. No atrocity he'd flinch from to get what he wants.
I'm worried about Emma Steele. She is perhaps the only true protector Logris has left.
What the hell are you doing in a place like this, Lennox? You can't trust a word that Durandal says.
I think I'm quite capable of choosing my own friends. And I don't think you ought to talk like that about Finn. He's Imperial Champion, and the greatest Paragon we've ever had.
You do realize we're going into the most dangerous and evil part of the city.
Absolutely looking forward to it, darling. Don't worry, I got all my gear. Whatever happens, we won't miss a thing. Oh, this is really terribly exciting.
Go to Aiden. Go to the Madness Maze. Every answer to every question you ever had can be found in the maze.
My friends, allow me to introduce to you James Campbell, first son of William and Niamh Campbell, the man born to be king!
Do you feel at all guilty about removing Douglas from the throne and replacing him with James?
No, he let me down. He let us all down.
God! Louis, that's Diana Virtue!
Johnny Cycle? But she's dead.
A lot of that going around.
You must go to Chandrakor, to the Forsaken World. I crash-landed the old Deathstalker standing there after the last battle. Go there, and in the old castle you will find things you need and things you need to know.
Oz, set a course for Chandrakor. It appears Hayden will have to wait for a while. After all.
Graphic Audio presents Simon R. Green's Deathstalker Return. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Vanessa Benjamin, Sonny Lasky, Corey James, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Dylan Lynch, Colleen Delaney, MB Van Dorn, Karen Carbone, James Konacek, Michael Oplogle, Chris Rowan, Christopher Graybill, Thomas Penny, and Mort Shelby. Episode 3, Changing Tides.
Perhaps the honored member can elaborate on exactly the nature of the levy he is proposing.
I'm sure we're all familiar with this, but just to be clear...
It was late in the day, and far later than anyone realized. Parliament was in session, no one was saying anything important, and King Douglas was almost dozing on his uncomfortable throne. The house was hot and stuffy, the guards were yawning into their armor, and everything seemed to move at a crawl. Nearly all the MPs were present, because the house was the last place where anyone listened to them anymore. The section set aside for aliens was almost deserted, with only a dozen or so species represented, because even the MPs didn't listen to aliens these days. The Esper representative was gone, his place taken by a smugly smiling clone representative. No one said anything about this. Everyone could see which way the wind was blowing. A single blue steel robot watched everything for Shub, and Douglas, King and Speaker to Parliament, was there because, well, because he had nowhere else to go, really. His presence was never required anywhere, and Barclay didn't even bother to brief him on the day's business anymore. He had been abandoned by friends and enemies alike, because events had passed him by. Power, real power, lay in the hands of those strong enough to grasp and hold on to it. Douglas didn't even bother trying to get people's attention these days. He played the part of a broken man so successfully that some days he wasn't sure whether he was acting or not. But still, he waited and watched, and hoped for a chance to do something. As it happened, he was currently resting his eyes during a particularly dull and protracted debate over value-added tax in the Outer Worlds. Just another day in what used to be the heart and conscience of the Empire. Everyone looked around sharply, including Douglas. Everyone recognized that particular fanfare. Finn Durandal had had it written especially for him. The Imperial Champion strode out onto the floor of the house, accompanied by James Campbell, the man who should have been king. Finn was tall and resplendent in his black leather armor, and James had never looked more grave and noble. The MP who had been speaking slunk back to his seat unnoticed. Everyone else was too busy murmuring urgently among themselves and congealing into their various factions. If Finn and James had come to the house, it meant something important was about to be decided. Perhaps by the MPs, perhaps not. Finn took up a commanding stance before Douglas on his throne and bowed a bow that held no obvious trace of mockery. Douglas gave him exactly the same kind of bow in return. Both of them ignored James.
My apologies for interrupting the business of this house, but a matter of some urgency has arisen. It is imperative that your brother James address the house. Do you give your permission, Your Majesty?
Of course, Sir Champion. Step forward, Brother James, and tell us what brings you to this house so urgently and unexpectedly.
James looked solemnly about him and struck a pose carefully calculated to suggest courage and determination in the face of adversity. Douglas felt like applauding.
Most honored members, I have no official standing here, I know that, but information has been made available to me of such importance that I must share it with the House. As I'm sure you're all aware, for some time now, Espers have been deserting their home worlds to come here to join with others of their kind in the separate city-state of New Hope, home to that most secret organization, the Oversoul. Humanity has, quite rightly, been suspicious of Espers ever since they used their unnatural powers to suppress the perfectly legal demonstration by Neumann outside this house, by possessing and controlling their minds. Just like those acknowledged terrorists, the Esper Liberation Front. Well, I have acquired solid evidence that the reason Espers have been gathering together is so that they can plan an attack against human authority. They intend to defy our just and reasonable demand that all Espers present themselves for conscription to be used as weapons against the coming terror. They intend, through force of numbers, to throw the law this house passed back in your faces and defy you to do anything about it. They cannot be allowed to reject your authority and evade their responsibilities. If they will not volunteer their special abilities in the defense of the realm, then they must be compelled. They must be brought to heel before their treacherous defiance spreads. I put it to this house that the time has come to register, control, and command all Espers in the Empire. they must be taught their place in the scheme of things. Those with suitable abilities should be sent to Heracles IV to stand against the coming terror, while others should be made available for scientific research to discover the true source of their powers, which they have always willfully held to themselves. It is long past time that these abilities should be shared equally by all humanity. There are numerous historical examples of precedents where this type of action...
There was a lot more, growing increasingly ugly and hateful, but Douglas tuned it out. Everything from then on was just rhetoric. Everything that mattered had already been said. James was proposing drafting all Espers, making them property again, as they had been in Lionstone's time. Some for cannon fodder, some for vivisection. It was a well-written speech, one of Anne Barclay's best, and it sickened Douglas that she should have turned her talents to such viciousness. He studied the house unobtrusively and was disturbed to see how well the speech was going down. In times of crisis, there's nothing authority delights in more than discovering some scapegoat to blame it all on. Standing just behind James, Finn smiled openly at Douglas, as though he knew what his king was thinking, and knew it didn't matter. The House was going to accept this proposal, and there was nothing Douglas could do to stop it, as Speaker or as King. Even trying to stand in its path would turn the House actively against him. So he stayed slumped on his throne, smiling and staring vacantly, and said nothing. His carefully crafted mask of disinterest was the only weapon he had left. For the moment. Finn studied Douglas carefully and felt a warm glow in his heart. It did him good to see how far his old friend had fallen. It seemed dear Jessamine had taken Douglas's balls with her when she left. All the fight had gone out of him. Soon enough, he'd be so beaten down, he'd be grateful for a chance to abdicate, and then James would take his throne by popular acclaim. And Finn would rule through James until he didn't need him anymore. Finn put Douglas out of his thoughts and concentrated on the real problem. The Espers had to be controlled. That was vital to Finn's plans for all kinds of reasons. They were just too powerful and too dangerous to be allowed to run free anymore. And besides, even Finn's S-blocker might not be enough to protect his thoughts if the Oversoul targeted him directly. So, a preemptive strike. Because it was necessary, and because he could. He'd never liked Espers. No one should have the right to be more dangerous than he.
Of its utmost peril, this shall be humanity's finest hour.
James's carefully crafted speech reached its end in a triumphant climax that brought the whole house to its feet, and the vast majority of MPs gave him a standing ovation. There were a few holdouts remaining stubbornly silent, but they were too isolated to be any problem. James looked about him, smiling bashfully, nodding his appreciation for their support. Finn clapped him on the shoulder in a manly, congratulatory way, and Douglas wanted desperately to get to his feet and make a speech of his own. He'd never needed Anne to write his words for him, not when they came from the heart. He could reach out to the hearts and minds of the house, woo them with sweet words and strong emotions, remind them of the Espers' long service to the Empire, defend their rights and the integrity of the house. But he didn't, because he knew it was already a lost cause. Helpless in the face of the coming terror, the house needed someone to strike back at. It had been months since Douglas's father, William, had been arrested, and still no one had been allowed to speak to him. There wasn't even any word of when William might be brought to trial. He remained a prisoner in House Campbell, where anything could be happening to him. Anything. So Douglas had no choice but to appear weak and beaten down and no trouble to anyone, while he worked furiously behind the scenes and in strictest secrecy to gather information on what Finn was really up to and build up ammunition to be used against him. The House had calmed down enough to vote in favor of James's proposal.
Well, James, I suppose the next step is mine. Given that the safety of the Empire itself is at stake, it is my duty as Imperial Champion to bring these Esper scum to heel.
Finn and James looked at Douglas, and Douglas nodded reluctantly.
Do what you must, Sir Champion. Go to New Hope and make Parliament's will clear to them. And Finn, good luck. You're going to need it.
Finn looked at him sharply, but Douglas met his gaze innocently enough, and Finn let the remark pass. He strode out of the house like a conqueror, with the cheers of the honorable members ringing in his ears. James followed quickly after him, and Douglas allowed himself a small, cold smile.
You're going to need all the luck you can get, Finn Durandal, against the Oversoul.
Outside the house, James looked about him. He was quite impressed by the sheer size of the armed force Finn had assembled. Weeding around and above the house were hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of gravity sleds, stacked in ascending levels up into the sky, all of them manned by pure humanity and church militant fanatics. Beyond and above them, dozens of huge gravity barges loomed ominously over the house, studded with ranks of waiting disruptor cannon. Finn's army blotted out the sky like a dark and angry cloud.
Jesus! There hasn't been this much firepower assembled in one place since the Great Rebellion. You could knock over some of the lesser worlds with an army this big.
Now, there's the thought. But first things first, eh?
You really think the Espers are going to put up that much of a fight?
Only a fool underestimates the Oversoul. You weren't here to see what just a handful of them did to the Neumann rioters. I've used up a hell of a lot of favors and influence, equipping my people with hundreds of Esp blockers. But even so, it'll be more of a fair match than I'm comfortable with. Still, at the end of the day, it always comes down to firepower. I'm going to blow the floating city of New Hope into a million pieces, and then pick off the surviving Espers as they fall to the ground. Oh, it's going to be such fun, I just know it. Now off you go, James. Back to Anne, and work on your next speech.
But I want to come with you. I want to see the action close up.
No, you don't.
Finn patted James on the cheek, and James flinched just a little in spite of himself.
You stick to speeches, James. That's what you're good at. Leave the atrocities to me. That's what I'm good at. And James, dear, never argue again with me in public.
He pinched James's cheek painfully, and James just stood there and took it.
Yes, sir.
James searched for a change of subject.
What would you have done if Parliament had said no?
Gone anyway, and to hell with them. Argue about the legality of it later. But I knew they wouldn't give me any trouble. Bunch of sheep.
He stepped up onto his waiting gravity sled, fired up the engines and checked the weapon systems, and then gave the signal to his waiting fleet. Slowly and ponderously, the gravity barges started forward, and the ranks of gravity sleds spread out across the sky. Humanity was going to war for the first time in centuries.
What about Douglas?
What about him?
He might stand against us while you're away.
He might have once, but he's not the man he was. I've seen to that.
Finn swept up into the sky to take the point, and the fleet moved off after him, heading for New Hope, heading for war. James waved and waved, but Finn never looked back. The Esper city of New Hope floated serenely 2 miles above the surface of Logris, vast and marvelous, with thrusting towers and brilliant lights, and complex structures of glass and porcelain. Once it was Logris's most precious jewel, acclaimed and adored from a safe distance. It was a lot bigger now than it used to be, more than 10 miles wide and almost 5 miles high. It had to be such a size to contain the millions of Espers who had come to New Hope from worlds all across the Empire, because New Hope was the only place they could feel safe anymore. And so the great floating city shone like a multicolored star, held up and held together by the massed minds of the Oversoul. The Espers were its power source and its weapons, its heart and its industry and its defenses. New Hope had a lot of defenses because the Espers still remembered what happened to the first city of that name in the bad old days of Lionstone's reign. Finn could see it before him, hanging on the darkening evening sky like a fairy tale palace, all turrets and spires and delicate walkways. It looked utterly splendid and completely defenseless. New Hope had no energy weapons, no attack ships, and Finn had the biggest aerial attack force since that used by the old Widowmaker to destroy the original New Hope, more than two centuries ago. The first Esper Sanctuary had been blown apart and put to the torch, and all its inhabitants slaughtered, and Finn saw no reason why history shouldn't repeat itself here today. He wasn't expecting any real problems. He was using the same tactics of overwhelming force and firepower, and all his key personnel and ships were protected by S-blockers. This wasn't going to be a battle, just an object lesson of what happened to those who dared defy Finn Durandal. He really should have known better. It's hard to hide anything from thousands of telepaths and remote viewers working in unison. They knew about Finn's attack force the moment it began assembling, and they already had a response worked out. They'd been waiting for the Durandal to turn his attention towards them. Every Esper in the Empire now lived on New Hope. All the others were dead, hunted down and killed by pure humanity mobs. So now, all the Espers that were came together and united in the Oversoul, and it gathered itself for battle, to strike the first blow against an empire that had turned bad and vicious like a mad dog. Crow-Jane, telepath, warrior, and devious thinker, strode back and forth across the landing pads at the edge of the floating city, broadcasting orders in all directions as she organized New Hope's defenses. Her mind was plugged into the intricate lattice of thoughts that made up the Oversoul's Operations Division, and decisions flashed back and forth in the mass consciousness, faster than lightning and more vivid, changing and adapting in an instant as conditions in and around the city changed. Crow-Jane made up her mind, and immediately men and women rushed to new assignments, ready for the fight. Around her, she could sense Poulters and Pyros and Precogs working calmly at their part of the plan, and she wouldn't let herself worry about them. Everyone knew what they were doing. There were no clashes or contradictions or misunderstandings in the Oversoul, and no regrets either. They would do what they had to. Every individual was the Oversoul in every way that mattered. Crow-Jane was a tall, statuesque brunette wearing sweeping black silks under a battered leather jacket and a bandolier of silver throwing stars. She wore a sword and a disruptor on her wide hips, and both weapons had seen a lot of use in their time. Crow-Jane had a pale face, jet black lips, heavy eye makeup, and a disturbing smile. She'd been trained as a battle Esper on Madriguda, fighting against the raw shark terrorists during the Quantum Inferno affair, and the Oversoul believed in making good use of every individual's talents. Crow-Jane's main talent was for organizing mayhem. 120 Espers assembled silently and efficiently before her, weighed down with battle armor and guns and explosives, and she smiled upon them like some ancient and awful death goddess.
You all volunteered, and you all know the score. The Durandal and his bastard army of fanatics will be here soon, and you have to buy the Oversoul time to do what it must. So get out there, cause chaos, run rings around them, and kill as many as you can. But above all, keep them occupied. They mustn't suspect what we have planned until it's far too late. Given the size of the attacking force, it's more than likely that I won't be seeing most of you again. The Oversoul will do its best to gather your minds into itself as your bodies are destroyed, but that may not be possible. The Icarus working must come first. There's still time for anyone to back out, if they don't think they're up to this.
She looked around, but no one said anything. They didn't have to. There were no secrets in the Oversoul. Crow-Jane smiled on them all, and let her pride and honored esteem wash briefly through their minds.
All right! Go and cause some trouble, you glory-seeking weirdos!
She felt their silent laughter in her mind as one by one they rose up into the air, ascending under the power of their own minds, so many angry angels rising up to smite a hated enemy. Crow-Jane watched them go, the gusting wind tangling in her long black hair and blowing tears from her eyes, till they were all out of sight. The Espers flew through the cold, thin air, protected from the harsh environment by the power of the Oversoul. Far below, the world turned slowly, ignorant of the bitter war about to be fought in the heavens. There was no aerial traffic, none of the usual freight wagons that cruised the high altitudes. Finn had had it all diverted. He didn't want any witnesses to what he was about to do. Memories of Lionstone's empire still existed within the Oversoul, and what one knew, everyone knew. The Espers flew faster, sworn to fight and die to the last man and woman, to ensure that New Hope would not fall again. Finn's fleet appeared over the curve of the horizon, and the Espers smiled as they saw their enemies for the first time. 120 Espers, set against gravity barges with the firepower of star cruisers and gravity sleds beyond counting. The Espers increased their speed, the chill wind whipping past them now. The foremost gravity barge targeted them with its tracking computers. Energy beams seared through the space where the Espers had been only a moment before. They scattered, streaking through the air in sudden zigzags, changing tack again and again, confusing the barge's battle computers with studied randomness. And then the Espers were in and among the fleet, and the barges couldn't fire for fear of hitting each other. The armed men riding the gravity sleds opened fire with their weapons, but the Espers were here and there and gone again, darting in and out of sight, flying too fast to be hit, too fast even to be anticipated. Joyfully, the Espers went to war. They flashed between and among the slower-moving gravity sleds, tricking the riders into shooting each other, and occasionally darting in close enough to tip the riders overboard. Energy weapons discharged all around the Espers, but they blocked the crackling energy beams with the force of their minds and sent them ricocheting back. Pure humanity soldiers were thrown from their sleds or burst into flames, so that their sleds spiraled slowly away from the fleet, heading earthwards with their scorched and charred burdens. Psychokinetic energies howled through the thin air, and sled engines blew apart. Sleds and riders fell like stones. Hand weapons exploded, blowing the hands and arms off their users. Hearts stopped, lungs flattened, brains crushed inside their skulls. The Espers were running loose in the heart of the fleet now, and blood and death and screams accompanied them. Some Espers were shot and killed, of course, dropping through the air like burning birds. Given the odds against them, it was inevitable. But they'd known that going in. And when they'd done all the damage they could, and their numbers had dropped to the danger point, the surviving Espers threw themselves at the hulking gravity barges, darting and dodging past the withering defensive fire, and slammed into the exposed engine vents at the rear of the barges, where they detonated themselves like psionic grenades. Steel hulls shattered, and waves of fire swept through the crowded corridors. Some began slow, controlled descents back to Earth, while they still could. But even after the 120 Espers had dashed themselves against Finn's fleet and given it everything they had, the main bulk of the fleet still pressed on, not even slowed. It was just too big to be turned aside by individuals, no matter how brave. The whole battle was over in less than half an hour. The fleet thundered on towards the floating city. On the landing pads of New Hope, Crojane saw the last Esper mind of the attacking force gutter and go out. The Oversoul hadn't been able to save any of the mines. The Icarus working was just too important to risk a lapse in concentration, even for a moment. Crojane could feel it assembling in the back of her mind, like a great engine slowly coming to life. A slight and diffident figure appeared suddenly beside her, and she jumped despite herself. The ecstatic called Joy was the only person on New Hope who wasn't a part of the Oversoul. Not least because the Oversoul didn't want anything to do with his mind. The last of his kind, Joy's brain had been surgically altered so that he lived in a state of constant orgasm. Theoretically, he was capable of accessing all kinds of altered states of consciousness, seeing the past and the future as well as the present. But mostly he just smiled a lot and said things that made sense only later, if then. He nodded companionably to Crojane as she recovered her composure. Perhaps his eyes were sad, too, It was hard to tell over that smile. He looked out into the sky, as though he could see the fleet coming.
Something is dying. Something is being born. The world turns, and something awful turns in its sleep, waiting to be summoned. We will all fly to glory. Nothing is ever forgotten. Nothing is ever lost. The man with the sundered mind will be here soon. It's going to rain tomorrow.
Crojane looked at him, too tired even to be properly exasperated. She would have liked to dig into his thoughts and drag out what he was really talking about, but knew better than to try. The few espers who tried to penetrate the ecstatic's mind had staggered away dazed and giggling and speaking in tongues. The few glimpses they got of his mind's workings, past the never-ending thunder of pure pleasure, baffled and disturbed them. Whole new ways of thinking that made no sense at all, or perhaps so much sense that the normal mind couldn't accommodate them. But sometimes Joy knew things, and sometimes he said things that mattered, so the Oversoul let him stay. It had a strange feeling it was going to need the ecstatic.
They'll be here soon. Stupid bastards. Don't they know that by attacking us, they're cutting their own throats? We were supposed to be the Empire's early warning system to guard against the coming of the Terror. With us gone, the next world in its path will get no warning at all.
You could still monitor the situation in exile.
Why should we? Let humanity die. Let all the stupid bastards die.
Joy was swaying slightly from side to side.
The Terror comes for us all. Wide-eyed and terrible, endlessly howling, a lamentation in the night.
Crojane ignored him. She could feel the Icarus working coming together in the back of her head, but something was wrong. Something was missing. Crojane felt a lurch in the mass consciousness of the Oversoul, as though a foot had reached down for a step that wasn't there. A vital component wasn't where it should have been. Jenny Psycho, the last living soul to be touched by the Mater Mundi and raised to greatness, the most powerful single mind in the Oversoul, wasn't there. She'd stepped out, gone away, vanished without even leaving a note to say when she'd be back. Crojane shared the shock and astonishment radiating throughout the Oversoul. Jenny Psycho's power had been a vital ingredient of the Icarus working. It could still go ahead. Even now, 1,000 minds were busy calculating the necessary changes, but suddenly the whole thing had become a hell of a lot chancier. And then the Girondol's fleet appeared on the horizon, and there was no more time. Crojane sank into the welcoming embrace of the Oversoul, one mind becoming many, as every Esper on New Hope joined into a single magnificent effort of will. The whole city blazed with light, brilliant and blinding, and even miles off in the distance, everyone in Finn's fleet had to turn their eyes away. The floating city, 10 miles wide and 5 high, began to shake. Millions of minds concentrated as one, and New Hope shook and shuddered as slowly, slowly, it began to rise. A great psionic pressure thundered on the air, a mental presence so strong that people all over Locus could feel it. The city of New Hope rose up through the rapidly thinning air, moving faster and faster, surrounded by its own shimmering force field. All of this power generated solely by Esper minds working in unison. Far below, helpless on his gravity sled, Finn Girondol watched his prey escaping and howled with rage. Even his armored gravity barges couldn't follow where New Hope was going. New Hope emerged from Logris' atmosphere and moved into orbit, leaving the world behind. The whole city glowed fiercely, a new star in the night, the Icarus working. Left behind, Finn Girondol yelled into his comm at the nearest star cruiser.
Intercept that city now! I want it taken down! It's their lives or yours!
The only ship in range was the Hammer. It moved ponderously around the curve of the world, heading for New Hope. It had barely moved into sensor range when all its systems failed. Computers crashed, backups aborted, and everything that could go wrong did. Life support systems collapsed, lights flickered on and off, the artificial gravity failed, and sudden fires broke out all through the ship. The Hammer drifted further and further off course and began the slow fall toward Logris. It had flown too close to the new sun in the heavens, and its wings had burned. the Oversoul concentrated one last time, and new hope disappeared. Hidden, undetectable, behind its own stealth shields. The Oversoul looked upon its works, saw them to be good, and considered where to go next. While the Oversoul was still planning its escape from Logris, Donald Corcoran was planning his escape from the asylum he was being held in. Corcoran was the first man to have looked upon the face of the Terror, at a great distance and via his ship's sensors, but he had looked upon the face of the Medusa, and the experience had marked him forever. He no longer thought as other men did. Medication didn't affect him, even in what would have been toxic doses for anyone else. He didn't eat or drink anymore, and he hadn't slept in months. He still wore his old spacer's uniform, now ragged and filthy, and he hadn't shaved or washed or even combed his hair since he'd been dragged screaming from the bridge of his ship in a straitjacket. He was being kept in a high-security asylum disguised as a country house, while doctors and scientists studied him from as safe a distance as possible. But Donald Corcoran had had enough of that. He plotted awful revenges against the Terror for what it had done to him, and for that, he needed to be free. Part of his disturbed mind was always in contact with the Terror, as though it had taken part of his mind with it when it disappeared back into the place it came from, the place that wasn't a place. The Terror was always there on the edges of his thoughts, like a nightmare waiting to begin. Sometimes he thought it could see him too, and the thought made him whimper and bite his fingers. But he could see the place the Terror came from, even when it wasn't there, a space beyond space. It was as real to him as the place that imprisoned him. It drew and terrified him, like a hunger for poisonous things. It was his way out. So one evening, when the shadow seemed particularly dark and restless, Donald Corcoran went walking through the grounds of the country house. The lawns were a vivid green, newly wet from the sprinklers. Wide blooming flowers perfumed the air with their scent, and the trees were very solid, but none of it was real, any more than the house was really a house. The house was an asylum, and the grounds were mostly hollow images, backed up by sound recordings and programmed smells. Donald could see right through them when he chose, though of course he never told the doctors that. Sometimes he could see right through them too. Donald went walking, stopping now and then to count and recount his fingers, because he had to keep checking the details of the few things he still believed in. Certainty had deserted him, blown away by the Gorgon's gaze. He couldn't trust anything anymore, except his own intentions. He moved his changed mind in certain unusual ways, and as he changed his mind, the world changed around him. He walked out of the illusionary garden and into a place that only looked like a place. It was cold and dark, like an endless stone corridor buried deep, deep below the ground, stretching away in every direction, including some he couldn't even name. It smelled of dead roses and a woman's sweat, and he could hear a baby crying in the distance, but he knew it wasn't really a baby. A great word hung unspoken on the air, held at bay by the implacable will of a woman wailing for her demon lover. The sorrow of it would have broken Donald's heart, if he still had one. He chose a direction and walked back into the world that everyone else agreed was real. In front of him was the door to his psychiatrist's office, Dr. Oisin Benjamin. Donald smiled, a not particularly nice or even sane smile. He pushed open the door without knocking and strolled into Dr. Benjamin's office. The doctor looked up from his desk, startled, and moved his hand automatically to cover the notes he was writing. Dr. Benjamin was a great one for writing notes. He didn't look especially pleased to see his star patient. Donald sat down in the visitor's chair and crossed his legs casually.
Donald? How did you... You're not supposed to be here, Donald. My appointments are over for the day. Why don't I ring for an attendant to escort you back to your quarters?
He was already reaching for the hidden alarm button to summon his bully boys in white coats when Donald launched himself out of his chair. He threw himself across the top of the desk and grasped Dr. Benjamin by the throat. The two of them fell backwards and crashed to the floor with Donald on top, straddling the doctor's chest. Dr. Benjamin struggled but couldn't break free, pinned down by Donald's weight. He opened his mouth to yell for help, and Donald hit him lightly in the face. The doctor's nose broke, and blood flew from his smashed mouth.
Sorry about that. Guess I don't know my own strength these days.
Corcoran paused, trying out various expressions on his face to see which would impress the doctor most.
Now be still. I'm here for a little chat. One last pleasant conversation before it's time for me to go. You should be pleased, Doctor. You've been trying to get me to open up to you for ever so long, haven't you? Trying to get inside my head to see the world as I do. Not a good idea, Dr. Benjamin. Trust me on this, if nothing else. Where I am, it is always cold and dark, and someone's crying. It might even be me. I hear the voices of all those who died on the Rim Worlds whispering around the edges of my thoughts. They don't like being dead again. And I can feel the terror moving slowly towards us, coming for us all. I want to run in every direction at once, but even more than that, I want revenge. I want my thoughts to be my own again. I want my life to make sense again. I want my old life back. That's not so much to ask, is it? I'm going to destroy the terror for what it's done to me! And I can't do that while I'm still here, so I'm off. Things to do. But before I go, good Dr. Benjamin, I have a present for you. One last gift to help you understand what's going on in my head.
He surged to his feet, dragging Dr. Benjamin up with him as though he were weightless. He grabbed one of the doctor's shoulders in each hand and pulled. Dr. Benjamin came apart, ripped in two, torn apart down the middle from the top of his head, down through his torso, and all the way to the groin. The two vertical halves fell away from each other as Donald let go and crashed to the carpeted floor. There was blood, but not a lot, before Donald sealed off both halves through the force of his will. Dr. Benjamin thrashed weakly on the floor, still alive, reaching out with his separated arms, a single eye rolling in each half head. Dr. Benjamin was kept alive by Donald's implacable will. Someone had noticed Donald Corcoran wasn't where he was supposed to be. He crossed quickly to the door of the doctor's office and then looked back at the two halves of his psychiatrist.
Now you know how I feel all the time.
With that, Donald Corcoran walked out of the room. Donald went walking through the corridors of the asylum, sometimes using the doors and sometimes not. He could feel guards coming his way with all kinds of restraints and weapons. Sometimes Donald avoided them by walking through walls. And sometimes he just turned sideways from the world and they couldn't see him. He made his way out of the asylum and into the street. There was no one about. The guards were all inside looking for him. Donald looked up into the sky and called to what was waiting. There was a pause, and then a long dark shape came plunging down out of the clouds to join him. It was sleek and silver, and it knew him. His old ship, the Jeremiah, had escaped from its dock and come looking for him. It too had been touched by the terror and was more than just a ship now. The madman and his mad ship looked upon each other and were glad. They belonged together. The ship hovered above him while he thought about what he should do, and when he stopped thinking, he was on the Jeremiah's Bridge. He could do things like that now. He gave the order, and his ship blasted off for orbit. The Jeremiah was a trader ship, built for speed and treachery. Illegally fast and protected by state-of-the-art stealth shields, there wasn't much on Logris that could catch or intercept it. Donald walked curiously through the shadowed corridors of the Jeremiah and it seemed to him that the old ship looked somewhat different. It had changed since he last saw it. After the Imperial Navy had boarded his ship against his wishes, strapped him into a straitjacket, and dragged him away screaming, the Jeremiah had been piloted to Logris and held in a star dock for observation. Donnell had known that without having to be told, just as he knew that many of the scientists sent to study the ship had quit because of the nightmares it was giving them. But he hadn't realized his ship had changed as much as he had, wandering off along new and little-used paths. The steel corridors of the Jeremiah were now tall Gothic arches, punctuated here and there with niches and crevices packed with fascinating things. Some of them looked almost alive. The ship's technology had grown, run wild, mutated. Strange new constructs of no certain function blinked at him from consoles with too many dimensions. Sometimes there was no lighting at all, but he could still see. The Jeremiah and he had been joined together by their experiences, on a level that nothing could break. The metal walls were comfortably warm under his touch. He returned to the bridge, and the main view screen showed him scenes of the damned, writhing and twisting, burning in hell. Donnell frowned, and the images disappeared. All through the ship, whispers had followed him, rising and falling like the sea, never ending, never still. He couldn't understand them yet, but he thought he might in time. The Jeremiah had been forced awake and aware through its contact with the Terror. Not just the AI, but the whole ship. And it hurt. Like its master, it ached for revenge. Or perhaps they both just craved death and the peace it promised. Either way, they would find the Terror and drag it down with them into hell if they could. As they were leaving orbit, they encountered the City of New Hope. The Jeremiah paused to match orbits, and the two vessels considered each other, the City of Light and the starship holding darkness within. On the Jeremiah's bridge, the view screen activated itself, showing Crow Jane and the ecstatic called Joy.
I know you. I watch the news, though I don't believe all of it. About time you got the hell out of there. It's only going to get worse, you know.
I know you, Captain Corcoran. I told them that place would never hold you if you wanted out. Do you know where you're going?
To the ends of the Empire and beyond. Off the edges of the maps and into the spaces marked here be monsters. I have business there.
Crow Jane turned to Joy.
You talk to him for a while. He sounds like your type.
Greetings, Captain. I think we should keep this short and to the point, because your ship is upsetting the Oversoul. It keeps trying to talk to them. I like roses. Do you see the Light people, too?
Yes, I do. I see them. They walk among us and no one knows. Which is kind of spooky if you think about it. But they don't bother me, so I don't bother them. Do you know where you're going?
There's currently some debate about that. We can't stay here indefinitely, but we're a long way from anywhere else.
You need to access hyperspace. It's easy. Look.
He reached out to the Oversoul and touched it with his altered thoughts. Both sides winced, but they held contact. Donnell could see into many places now, and hyperspace was one of them. He showed the Oversoul a direction to look in that they had never suspected existed. And there was hyperspace, waiting for them. Donnell withdrew, hiding inside his own head again, leaving the Oversoul with new possibilities and a massive collective headache.
Go to Mistworld. I did a lot of trade there when I was still sane. They're still rebels at heart, and they have defenses that could stand off whatever the Empire sends against them. They'll take you in. They remember what it was like to be hunted. I was happy there. It seems such a long time ago.
Don't be sad. The universe isn't as dark as it seems. The long night is full of stars, and the worlds are full of people. Who could have predicted that? We are not alone. There is comfort.
I don't want it. I only want revenge now. It's all that's been left to me.
Crow Jane has conjectured that the Terror could be some part of the Recreated that was never made human again by the Blessed Owen.
It's bigger than that. It lives in more than three dimensions. Its spawn incubates in the hearts of suns. It eats souls. It wants to destroy the whole universe and everything in it. Unless I kill it first. I can see it. I can always see it, no matter what place it's in. Part of me is there with it, and it suffers.
How can you hope to stop it?
Donald smiled.
It pushed me into hell. And now that I know the way, I'm going to grab the terror and drag it down into damnation forever with me.
Hope you've got a backup plan.
Best of luck, Captain Corcoran. Perhaps we'll meet again someday.
It doesn't seem likely.
He broke contact, and the two vessels passed each other in the night, each going its separate way. Treasure Mackenzie, that almost impossibly gorgeous star of the vid soap The Quality, was going to have dinner with her husband-to-be, King Douglas. He wasn't expecting her. She contacted him on the viewscreen in his private chambers, using a private number she shouldn't have known about, and invited him to join her at one of the most famous and fashionable restaurants in the city. The kind of place where you had to get on a waiting list just to bribe the maitre d'. But of course, people like Treasure never needed a reservation, as long as her ratings held up. Douglas explained to her very politely that the dinner date wasn't possible. For reasons of security, Finn Durandal had decided that it wasn't safe for the king to leave his palace, except to go to the house, and then only when protected by Finn's guards. Treasure pouted prettily, wrinkled her perfect brow, and then smiled brightly.
Not to worry.
When Douglas opened the door, she barged right in, followed by half a dozen waiters from that very fashionable restaurant, pushing trolleys loaded down with everything necessary for a full-scale banquet. There were main courses, side courses, and between courses, and a selection of snacks to keep them going while they decided which course to have next. Just the smell alone would have fed a family of six for a month. If anyone else had asked the restaurant to provide such a meal to go, they would have laughed in their face. But of course, nothing was too much trouble for Treasure Mackenzie.
Not on that table, darling. On the other table. Wonderful.
She bustled about the room, directing the waiters on where to set things up, making sure everything was to her satisfaction before she signed the bill with a practiced flourish. She then signed autographs for all the waiters, kissed the youngest on the cheek just to see him blush, and then shooed them all out.
Thank you, bye.
Treasure stared at Douglas.
I didn't know what you liked, so I brought everything.
So I see. How did you get past the guards at my door? They usually have strict instructions not to let anyone in.
Pure charm, darling. And several deep breaths. Cleavage will get you places even security passes won't. Shall we make a start?
They sat down facing each other across Douglas's dining table. Treasure helped herself to generous amounts of everything on offer, piling her plate high, while Douglas filled his plate more cautiously. He was still trying to work out exactly what was going on here. He opened the wine expertly, pausing a moment to approve of the excellent vintage, and poured out two tall, thin glasses. Treasure rewarded him with her trademark wide smile. Douglas had to admit it really was a very nice smile. He was glad he'd made the decision to clean himself up. He would have hated for her to see him the way he used to be. As it was, they made a striking enough couple. He with his handsome face and golden hair, Treasure with her famous sensual face, and a great mane of pure white hair tumbling down past her bare shoulders. It had to be said, she had the most delightful collarbones. Treasure finally finished loading up her plate.
Are you sure you've got enough there?
The joys of a fast-moving metabolism, darling. I burn it all off through nervous energy. Besides, I've always believed that appetites should be satisfied. Anything less is unnatural and unhealthy.
So you eat like this all the time?
Oh, hell no. My agent would have a fit if she could see me now. There are very strict clauses in my contract about being overweight. But this is a special occasion.
It is?
Oh, yes. Drink up, darling. You don't want to get left behind, do you?
Douglas had to smile. In her own ingenuous way, Treasure was as unstoppable as a force of nature. She attacked her food happily, wolfing it all down with good appetite, and Douglas ate his quite excellent food at a somewhat slower pace, so he could study his dinner companion unobtrusively. Her long, flowing off-the-shoulder gown was shimmering silver, studded here and there with semi-precious stones, carefully designed to amplify and draw attention to her fabulous cleavage, as if it needed any help. Seen away from the camera, and with rather more understated makeup than usual, Treasure's face was pretty rather than beautiful, given strength by her pointed chin and blazing green eyes. Her gaze was direct and untroubled, and she chattered happily about nothing in particular, in between and sometimes during large mouthfuls of food. She ate with her fingers when she felt like it, and didn't give a damn. Douglas watched her carefully, in much the same way he would have watched a dangerous opponent in the arena, to see which way the attack might come from. Treasure was charming, if undemanding, company, and certainly easy enough on the eyes, but Douglas thought he knew a planned seduction when he saw one charging straight at him. Clearly, Treasure had decided to make sure she had him properly infatuated with her before the wedding, so there wouldn't be any problems this time. Douglas smiled and poured more wine for both of them. He'd been dodging predatory women since he was a teenager. There's nothing like being the only heir to the throne of the Empire to make one apparently irresistible to women. So he ate with a good appetite, and nodded pleasantly back at Treasure as she chattered away. Why not? It was something to do, and thanks to Finn Bloody Durandal, he didn't get out much these days. It was good to have company. And she was going to be his wife, eventually. Douglas wondered if Treasure knew that he meant to put off the ceremony for as long as he could. Perhaps she guessed it, and that was what this dinner was for. Certainly she was making every effort to charm, chase, and vamp him, and with anyone else she would probably have succeeded. You'd have to be dead from the neck down not to feel Treasure's appeal. Having the full force of her sexuality turned on you was like staring into an open blast furnace. But Douglas still loved Jessamine. Stupidly, hopelessly, helplessly. Because love is like that when it strikes a man in later life. Douglas had never really cared for anyone before. He'd never wanted for female company, and had been genuinely fond of most of them. But he'd always known that mostly he tended to choose his women by how much they'd piss off his father. But he'd loved Jessamine from the moment he met her. And he'd thought she cared for him. Perhaps she had, in her way. But she'd still left him to be with Lewis. It didn't matter. He still loved her. And always would. Besides, Douglas didn't entirely trust Treasure's motives. You didn't get to be a major vid star without ruthless ambition and determination far beyond the norm. She'd never be content to be just a trophy wife on his arm. Make her queen, and she'd find ways to exercise power, real power, either on her own or through her dominated husband. So Douglas ate his meal and drank his wine, gracefully sidestepped her little traps and seductions, and watched it all with quiet amusement. It had been a long time since he'd had anything to smile at. Behind her smile, Treasure was watching him with increasing annoyance. Even her most practiced techniques came to nothing against this man's casual self-possession. Look at him, eating the most expensive food in the Empire as though it was just another meal, and smiling at her as though she was just another woman. She wasn't used to having her magnificent presence taken for granted. Most men lost the thread of what they were saying every time she took a deep breath and spilt their wine if she deigned to lean forward. She was beginning to get just a little angry. She was a star, damn it. She even lowered herself to being a good listener, only to find Douglas had nothing much to say. She'd set up this meal specifically to discover whether the king really was the broken man he appeared to be, but she was no closer to finding out. His face was open and amiable, his manner dull but pleasant, and neither face nor voice gave any clues as to what was going on in his mind. She'd come here with every intention of seducing the man, but he didn't seem interested in that either, which was practically unheard of. Perhaps the Durandal was doping him? That would explain a lot. But Frankie had to be sure. The Hellfire Club needed to be sure. There was a lot she could do as queen to advance the Hellfire Club's agenda in public and in private, but not if the king opposed her. Douglas had killed dozens of Hellfire Club devils in his days as a paragon, when he was still a man to be reckoned with. If he still was. She let her hand drift casually closer to the long, slender dagger secretly sheathed on her upper right thigh. No one had body searched her. No one had dared. She could kill him if she had to. But it would be such a wasted opportunity if he could be turned. The things she could do as queen. The terrible, wonderful things. She focused on the creed of the Hellfire Club.
Thou shalt not love. Thou shalt not be weak. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
How are the baby mice stuffed with hummingbirds' tongues?
A little overspiced, I fear.
Treasure almost ground her teeth together. She held out her glass for him to fill and arranged it so that her fingers brushed his lightly. He didn't even seem to notice. Maybe if she just grabbed his face and jammed it between her breasts. She indicated that she'd had enough to eat, and he agreed. They moved away from the table and took their drinks over to the fireplace. He was still being pleasant and even gallant in a rather vague way, and Treasure, or rather Frankie, had had enough.
Oh, the hell with it.
She pushed Douglas back against the wall and slammed her body up against his. Her magnificent breasts flattened against his manly chest. His arms went around her automatically. She grabbed his head with both hands and pulled his mouth towards her waiting lips. And Douglas grabbed her bare shoulders and pushed her away from him with such force that she fell backwards onto the thickly carpeted floor. She sat down hard on her well-padded bottom and glared up at him, hair disheveled, breathing heavily, and their eyes met. And for just a moment, they both saw the real person behind each other's public mask. They regarded each other coldly, and then the masks slipped smoothly back into place. Douglas leaned forward, offering his hand. Treasure accepted it and rose to her feet with dignity. She brushed herself down here and there, adjusted her décolletage, and ran her hands through her long white hair. Her breathing was perfectly calm now, as was his.
It's Jessamine, isn't it? After all she's done to you, it's still Jessamine.
Yes, I'm afraid it is.
What could she offer you that I can't?
If you have to ask, my dear, you'll never know.
Two bright spots burned angrily on Treasure's cheeks.
I will be your wife and your queen, Douglas.
Yes, I'm afraid you probably will be. I hope you get more out of it than I ever have through being king.
Someday, you will kneel to me, Douglas.
I suppose hell has to freeze over sometime. Thanks for dinner. We must do this again sometime.
Treasure Mackenzie swept out of Douglas's quarters, trailing her tattered dignity behind her. Douglas went back to the dinner table and wondered if he could find the room for just a little more. It really was excellent food, and it would be a shame to let it go to waste.